Hi, and welcome to Practical Reliability. I'm George Williams, founder and CEO of ReliabilityX, and today we have Mr. Brian Bieschke. He's the owner of Align Machine Company. Brian, welcome.
Thank you, George. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be sitting where Ramesh Gulati has sat at one point, kind of fanboying a bit here, not to discredit you. I'm glad that you're next to me as well. But yeah, thank you for having me. I'm glad we were able to do this today.
Yeah, we had to raise the mic because when Ramesh sits there, it's usually a little
lower. He
wasn't
standing back here? Okay.
Well, welcome. It's really a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
And you're a pretty relevant name in the industry. We kind of see you all over LinkedIn and stuff like that. But you have this venture going on, Align Machine Company. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who Align Machine Company is and what you do?
Sure. Yes, thank you. So Align Machine Company was my brainchild of trying to blend my love of heavy equipment and actually doing the work, turning wrenches, with consulting for culture and industry, heavy industry. You know, I'm not in manufacturing plants doing the things like the awesome stuff that you're doing. I'm in at the farms. I'm in at the heavy equipment mobile shops, things like that. And, you know, Align Machine Company started out more consulting with, you know, helping people set up their workflows for heavy and industrial equipment, asset management, fleet management, all those things. And then eventually I couldn't keep my hands out of touching stuff. So I bought a service truck and now I will literally go and work on machines and set up programs for people's physical assets, troubleshoot, repair, maintain. And I'm currently in the process of trying to expand that part of the business. And it's been great. I love it. And it's amazing to see people's success through sound repair, sound service, sound strategy, as opposed to just, oh, we replaced that part. No, I can fix that part, right? And I can tell you why it broke and how we can avoid it in the long term.
I think that's interesting, especially in the space of agriculture and machinery. And you know, you've got like different classes of equipment that exist in that space, right? You've got really large for-profit major farms, and they probably, you know, whether their programs are good or not, they've got the horsepower and everything to 100%. Kind of keep things there. But then you've got a lot of mid-size
and family farms.
Where, you know, they're used to just beating, you know, I got a 2x4, I got to beat this bearing into place. And so you're coming in there not only to fix the equipment, but kind of educate them and put them on a path of profitability where in the past, that downtime, that piece of equipment being down is the difference between eating and not eating.
That's right. And I have several customers who rely on one or two pieces of machinery to put food on the table or to put food in the community, right? At a fruit stand or at a farmer's market or something like that. And it's true, over time, people have had to have the means or have had to create ways of making things work. And sometimes they're not always the best way. And then it evolves into more problems in the long run, right? And it's right, a large portion of my physical work on machines is to ensure that that farmer or that small business or that family can achieve, I don't want to say reliability, but achieve the availability of their machines long term. And it is as simple as just saying, hey, when I replace this bearing in your hay cutting machine, I realized A, B, C, and D. And if you do X, Y, and Z, then we can extend the life of this bearing. Or, hey, don't dump 5-gallon buckets full of fuel into your machine. Let's try to get a tank or a pump or something that we can do to ensure that we're putting clean, waterless fuel in your system. So it can be very, very complicated or it can be very, very simple. But at the end of the day, it's so valuable for me to see people become self-sufficient, even if I lose that customer. So sometimes I will come and troubleshoot, repair, and maintain or whatever a machine, give advice, and I will never see that customer again.
Well, because you did your job.
Right. So it is sometimes that happens. And sometimes it creates a relationship where they go, you know what? I want you to come back so that we can ensure that this thing is now correct. And what are your thoughts on this thing, right? But yes, that is it. And it's not just that. It's even small outfits and landscaping companies and wood processing companies and even small construction companies, right? They're working on these such razor thin margins.
Oh yeah.
And downtime is a huge thing. And the cost of that downtime that's associated with not just the machine not doing work, but the cost to repair it, are very, very, very tight things that need to be addressed. And I have the ability to work with those people. I also have the ability to troubleshoot and repair things correctly. So when they pay me to come one time, they're not paying me to come again.
Right.
Which I think is extremely valuable, because we see so many parts throwing and guessing and, oh, this is what this said.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So part swappers are my favorite. They're like the number one maintenance people everywhere we go is the part swapper.
Now, are things going to need to be replaced? Sure, of course.
Well, last time it was this, so let's replace that. And if that doesn't do it, well, it must be this then.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, no, I'm very, very glad to be doing that. And it's cool to see people in our industry that have reached out to me to come and help them with their unique problems at their own facilities and farms and things like
that. Yeah, I saw some videos with you out at Rich's.
Yes, Rich Wurzbach is a friend of mine and a wonderful
Grease
lubrication.
Thief and
wonderful lubrication expert.
He's got an awesome train set.
He's the man. I'm telling you, he's the man. And every time I go there and I'm working on his machines, I'm always picking his brain about lubrication reliability. And he always explains so much cool stuff to me.
Yeah,
and it's just so wild.
Yeah.
And he's a cool, real cool dude. I'm actually trying to go there tomorrow.
You've got reliability nerds, and then you've got guys like Rich that are in such a niche.
Yes,
and they're so intelligent about that. You know, guys like Motor Doc and you've got
Henry.
Penrose
or Howard. Yeah, Howard Penrose.
You've got just people in this industry that have gotten their niche down to such a science, and they keep evolving it and keep inventing even better. Those people are just my heroes. Dude, just fantastic.
They're awesome. Motor Doc is a funny you say that, because I don't really know him, but I do follow him, and I look at some of the stuff that he comments on and says. He's so blunt and to the point, and I love it. Just no BS, just like cutting right through it, and you can't. He's the guy.
And he'll give you the science behind it.
He's the guy.
And you'll be lost three sentences into it, and he'll go on for a half hour explaining the science. And he could be BSing you, and you wouldn't know. But he's so good. Like, he just knows this stuff. He's just incredibly intelligent guy.
And if you have Reliability X stickers, you got to give me one. So I can put on the back of my service truck, because Rich gave me a Grease Thief sticker.
Oh, yeah.
And I put all the companies that I mess with, I put them on the back of my service truck.
We've got bobbleheads you can put on the dashboard. And it'll, you know, go like the old dog.
I want Ramesh.
So, all right. So the work that you're doing, it's needed in the United States, right? I mean, especially those mid-size and small and family-run farms where, you know, a day older in the crop means yield is different.
Sure.
And they may not understand reliability, but they certainly understand the impact of reliability.
Yes.
How much of what you do is educating that industry and those folks in that space?
Sure. I would say it's like 75-25. You know, the number one goal that I'm reached out to normally is because my thing is broken and I need it because I need to produce or I need to achieve X, Y, and Z. And I take that opportunity to educate and to leverage the unfortunate circumstance to show that there's value long term in something else. And it's very common. And I execute it. I'm not waiting for them to come stand over my shoulder and go, why is that broken? Now I'm going to say, hey, this is why this happened, right? And I also, me being a maintenance reliability person, I use my own CMMS. I track all work on work orders. All time is tracked when I'm there on your facility. I give you a detailed report, an account with pictures and specifications and documentation showing how the repair or the troubleshooting process was achieved and what the outcome was and what the root cause was to a point, right? I'm not perfect, right? But I can make assumptions and based on facts that I have at the time. And every customer receives that work order. But before they even receive that work order, they're seeing me. And I'm going to talk about all those things with them and how we can get ahead of things and how we can change the way we operate. Just operating the machine, ensuring that it's within its context, right? That it's designed to be operated at. And just that, I mean, you know, even in my job, like bigger business, just operating something the way it should be operated can take you from relatively low availability to somewhat high availability, right?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. The operator plays probably a more significant role. So I use this analogy often when I teach. There are Model T Fords on the road today, 100%. And there are Model T Fords that have rusted to nothing in somebody's backyard. The difference was not how well the mechanic did.
Right. Yeah, it was what you did with it.
It was how well the operator took care of it, whether or not they kept it clean, whether or not they operated it appropriately. The difference isn't because the mechanic screwed you.
No. And it's funny you say that, because I remember our first conversation together. We talked about operators and talking about the difference between why operators in manufacturing or production line supervisors in manufacturing are somewhat different than the operator of a mining truck, right? And I think I used the points like the operator in mining truck directly correlates just by them being in the seat directly is correlated to the availability of that machine. When in a manufacturing line, there are some things that are built in that kind of keep it on pace, right? But a guy just driving too fast into a turn in a large mining truck, you can increase strut wear and tire wear. And you know, there's all these things.
Oh, yeah.
But operators in farming, in anything that an operator is directly controlling the context of the operation, can really make an impact on how it's operated, and especially long term, right? So all those things compound over time.
Yeah, no doubt. And you're right. It's no different in manufacturing. I think in manufacturing, the difference is when the machine experiences a problem, they immediately attribute it to being a maintenance issue.
Sure.
And not necessarily an operational issue.
Right.
And so we, at least in this space, we kind of deal with that often.
Yes.
And in your space, you have to derive that. You have to interview people to figure that out, right? It's not so self-evident.
Sure.
Especially, I mean, you brought up mining. We'll just use that as an example. Scoop blade wear.
Oh, yeah,
is an operator GAT, issue,
ground engaging
right?
Tools, yeah.
Right, so that's an operator issue, right?
Sure.
Whether you're at the right angle.
That was the example we used last time.
Yeah.
If you're back dragging with a bucket and you lay the whole bucket on the ground, you're going to wear the back of the bucket out.
Right.
But if you use the cutting edge, which is designed to wear out, then you're going to the life of your bucket now is exponentially increased.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. I think it's very cool, and I'm always. I am in manufacturing now, my actual job, but with the Lime Machine Company, and it being my focus is just so much with the heavy equipment, the farming, the all those things, and it's really neat to see and meet people. I mean, you meet so many people. Like, I never thought that like Rich was going to reach out to me and be like, my telehandler or my manlift's broken, need the cylinder rebuilt. And we set it up, and I was there the next weekend.
Beautiful.
Pulling it out, rebuilding the thing for him. And now we have this relationship, and I learned so much from people like that, even from the farmer who doesn't do maintenance and reliability.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's just so much to be learned.
Well, you learn why components fail based on how the operator's treating the equipment, right? And you can kind of start to develop correlations the more experience you're in the space. You kind of get that.
And in our industry, too, like I like to take the approach where when I'm training technicians or training maintenance personnel, I want them, the very first thing I want them is to go back is how the machine should be operating. You know, a lot of times we get tunnel vision or we get the blinders on and we go and like, oh, I'm looking for this problem, right? But at the end of the day, a large percentage of problems are not a problem. They're a change in operation. And I always like the technician to go back and say, was the machine started properly? Was the machine shut down properly? Was the machine being operated within the context that is appropriate? And I have the technicians go back and evaluate that first.
Right.
Because 9 times out of 10, they find that, oh, they didn't make this switch first. They started here, and that needs to be made first, and that's why the machine's an alarm.
I worked at a company where they, whenever a piece of equipment went down, they did what they called a crime scene investigation. They did a virtual tape off of the area, and that's exactly what they did. They interviewed people. They, you know, took pictures. Before anyone tries to turn this back on, the only way we're going to know what happened is to be able to investigate it. So take the 20 minutes and figure all those things out so you can avoid that failure in the future.
Yes.
So I have one more question about the your clients and the farming and heavy equipment. How much of an effort, or I don't want to say it's an effort, and I don't want to make assumptions here, but you've got to run into folks that are just like, well, just fix my machine.
Yes.
Can you just fix it and let me get back into the field?
Of course.
And that's no different than anyone else in this industry in maintenance and reliability finds themselves inside a plant when trying to educate the maintainers that there may be a better way, right?
Sure.
They've got a whole life's experience you know, that the farmer's going, I've got 50 years of farming. And you're like, I know, but you just keep going back and forth over the same land. Like it's right. 1 year of experience, 50 times, it's not the same.
Yeah, that's right.
So how do you crack through that? Like, you know, like how do you get on the same level and crack through that?
Sure. So the first thing I'll say just from a fundamental standpoint is I document everything and I take pictures of everything. So I'm kind of segueing a bit, but if I make a recommendation, if they say, fix this thing and put it back to work, I fix their thing. In the process of me fixing it, I'm still doing what I'm supposed to be doing, right?
Right.
I'm still documenting. I'm still writing up some form of cause, correction, and confirmation and all those things. And then I will make it known to them. And sometimes they don't want to hear it. It's true. And that's people. But I give them the benefit of the doubt and go, all right, they just want their thing fixed. I make the recommendation. And I try to talk to them in person while I'm there to try to explain kind of what I found. If they don't want to hear it, I go, great. And then I will send them the work order and I'll just tell them, hey, follow up, please let me know. And I also make a point to say, like, if we do these things, there's a large chance that we won't be revisiting this in the next 6 months. And by the way, I know that you're going to be seeding and planting in the next 6 months. So it might be beneficial if we get ahead of this now,
right,
as opposed to waiting till your machines broke down in the field and you're telling me that in 2 weeks you're going to be screwed if we don't do this work, right? So I try to use each individual's unique circumstance. I don't want to say leverage, but to educate, to help them understand that if you're just telling me to fix it and just forget about it, you're going to pay for that.
Right.
I'm not going to pay for that.
Right, right, right.
Right? You're going to pay me for that.
Right. Right?
If they call me back, which they
do. Yeah.
But that's how I kind of get to it. And there are those hard ones where they don't want to hear it. And it's okay. I mean, like you said, they've been doing 50 years,
right,
50 times.
They're in their way. Yeah.
I'm not changing that.
Right.
But I do provide enough information and enough context for them to, if they so choose to accept it, that they'll have an understanding of what happened. And if they want to address it, they can. And I will certainly help facilitate that.
What are some of the toughest things to troubleshoot for you?
For me personally?
Threw you on the spot there, but
yeah, you did. I do
nothing. I find every problem did. Right away.
You found it. Paid consultant. So I like to think that I'm very strong in electrical troubleshooting. I kind of gravitated toward that in service. A lot of the machines I worked on were electronic and electrical generators, power supplies, and static frequency converters and things like that. I also have a strong understanding of engines and things like that. I think that when it gets into machines that are some emission systems, some are passive, some are active.
Right.
It really comes down to, do I have the means or tooling to appropriately assess?
Right.
There are so many variations of machines and from hydraulic, electrical, engines, power supply, you know, power plants, powertrains, emissions. There's so many different types of tooling that you need to be able to encompass many, many types of equipment. So if I walk up to a Caterpillar machine, I worked for Caterpillar, I have CAT electronic technicians, SysWeb, I know I can do everything that I need to do.
Right.
If I walk up to a Komatsu, I have a lot of experience, but I may not have the appropriate tooling to do the correct thing. So then it leaves me this window where I kind of have to work off of experience.
Right.
And understanding the fundamentals of electricity, the fundamentals of hydraulics, and know about counterbalance valves and relief valves and relays and all these things. So I would say it's not really a type of problem. It's more, do I have the means to accurately and appropriately address a individual problem? It could be hydraulic, could be electrical, could be an engine.
Right, right, right.
And it happens. I don't own every tool. I don't own every electronic service.
Yet.
I don't own every electronic service tool or something like that, right? I would say that's probably it.
What do you enjoy most?
Electrical. A large portion of my business is electrical troubleshooting, mainly because it's a very misunderstood part of machinery. Most of the time people are like, oh, electrician does that. Well, in heavy equipment, you are the electrician. You're not calling an electrician to come fix your dozer that has an electrical problem. No, you're calling a heavy equipment mechanic who knows electrical for a machine, right? 24 volts DC, 12 volts DC. But I love electrical troubleshooting. I was known for it at Caterpillar. I'm kind of known for it now. If you Google alignmachinecompany.com or Align Machine Company, you'll see I have all 5-star reviews. You'll see in the reviews that they talk about electrical, they talk about me rebuilding people's engines, troubleshooting things that other people didn't want to or couldn't.
Right.
But electrical is one of those things that's kind of a gray area for a lot of people. Like, you might find a really good heavy equipment mechanic who knows powertrains, engines, transmissions, and final drives and stuff like that, but they kind of stray away if it's not obvious, like the battery's dead or
right.
or this wire is broken. I check continuity, and then they kind of step away from it. But that's why I like heavy equipment so much. It's because it's such an all-encompassing thing.
Yeah.
If you're a heavy equipment mechanic, you do electrical, you do hydraulics, you do mechanical, you do welding, you do all these things, and I think it's really cool.
Yeah. That's rewarding, right? It's the whole reason everyone in maintenance became a maintenance person is because they like that reward. They like to troubleshoot and solve.
And it's real. It's right in front of
you. Fix.
It's right in front of you.
Yeah.
I like to call it, this is like the real-time results. You're literally...
Right. It either starts and runs or it doesn't.
That's right. That's right. You've started something. Oh, my God. Now it's what it's supposed to be. Right in front of me. I don't have to wait. I don't have to go look at this. I don't have to do all these things. Right? It's right there, and it's achieved.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, that's exactly why folks in maintenance... So let's shift gears just a little bit from heavy equipment to generalized maintenance and reliability. You're also in that space.
Yep.
What do you enjoy about that space?
So my favorite thing about maintenance and reliability is knowing that and being a part of the fact that maintenance and reliability is not the problem. Culture and alignment of business and holistic business is generally the problem. And maintenance and reliability comes second to that.
Really far past that. I mean, when we go into plants and we look up and we do studies, I mean, we find less than 10% of the issues in a typical manufacturing facility or maintenance related.
That's right. But it's the easiest one to put the issue on.
Oh, yeah, because it's obvious.
Because
there is one, it's obvious,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You. The word machine is synonymous with maintenance.
Right.
But it really should be synonymous with how do I operate this thing? Yeah, what is it? What should it be doing?
What's it supposed to do?
What's it supposed to do, and how does it affect the business?
Right.
Is it closer to the end of the line? Is it further away? You know, so I like building relationships. I like talking to people. I like getting out there and doing the work and being a part of what is actually happening. I like to call it the reality of what the department is. Because the reality of the department isn't a graph that shows you your PM compliance.
That's for sure.
Right? That could be either really, really accurate or completely wrong.
And who cares? If it's good and your PMs are terrible,
correct.
Did it add value? It's like a tree falling in the woods when no one around, right?
And if the technician doesn't understand his task list, he doesn't have the proper tooling or training to understand the task list, the machines aren't available when they're scheduled to be available.
And PM compliance just means it got closed out in the CMMS.
Correct.
That's all that means.
We did this and we closed it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, but that's probably my favorite thing is going in and seeing an impact at the core of what the department is, which to me is the culture of the people and how the maintenance department is directly aligning itself with the bigger business or the local business, whichever one that is driving the overall either availability or product packed pounds, product out the door, units per minute, whatever that is.
Right.
And I always try to find the correlation between the two. Right. I get the question all the time. It's like, well, how would you know that your maintenance and reliability process or strategy is effective? And it can be many things based on the business, right? But the first one I go to is like, when's the last time that machine stopped? It's very simple, right? When has it stopped? Well, it hasn't. Well, I think we're doing something okay.
For me, the gauge is pretty simple. Do people look relaxed in the plant? And can you hear the rhythm of the plant?
That's a good one, yeah.
Like, you can
Joe said it best. He said, when we used to sit in the break room.
Read a book. Right.
And when
then we know we're good.
Someone would come in and yell at us, and we'd cue the radio and go, do you hear that? That's the sound of machines running.
Right. Yeah. But when you walk through a plant, you can hear the rhythm of the plant and you can hear when it's not in rhythm. And when you see operators and maintainers and they're doing their work diligently, but calmly, you know, everything's in good shape.
Sure.
You can walk through two places. You walk the plant floor and you walk the maintenance shop. And in those two places, you know, everything you need to know about a plant.
Right.
If you want more insight, you go walk through all the conference rooms, and if they're loaded with people talking about how they're going to have a next meeting, follow-up meeting, you know that the place is a wreck, right? So it really doesn't take a lot to get your pulse on it, and the solutions are easy theoretically.
Right.
They're extremely difficult practically.
Right. Because of this, you've got to break through the transactional type people in the business, right?
Yes. Yeah.
We're talking about the VP level, the people who are viewing this journey of reliability or journey of maintenance as a transaction. It's like, I pay this much money, I get this out of it.
Right.
It's very difficult to communicate that value.
Right.
You know, and that's why I like, you know, when I enter those types of conversations, I try to focus on very low hanging fruit, right? High probability, high impact with the least amount of resources and effort.
Right.
And those are the first things we attack. First thing I attack when I go into a facility, and I use those quick wins, those things that he may notice, right? That are, oh my God, every time I walk by this thing, it's spilling all over the place, right? And you address that thing. And then they start to see, okay. And then, of course, it's not that easy. But you can start to maybe build that relationship or that data to say, hey, these are the things you were concerned about. This is the things we were able to achieve. This is the output that was given by your local team, whatever. And then maybe we can multiply, amplify, or whatever, go on from there.
The hardest part is getting people to understand. Like, so we talked a little bit ago about the Model T and the operator and how critical that was. Oftentimes, the second least paid person in the plant is the operator.
It's true.
You got the folks that are, you know, cleaning bathrooms and doing the custodial work, and then just above them you've got operators.
Yeah.
And we're not investing in ensuring that the asset is going to run properly.
Sure.
We're not investing in educating them in the process of the product flowing through the equipment, so they have no idea what the dials and settings do. And so that's always a challenge.
Yes.
And oftentimes companies become very top heavy.
Oh, I know exactly what you're saying.
We're going to try it. We're going to do all this money and spend all this money so we can cut the people on the floor.
Yeah.
And you're going, look, man, like, no offense, but companies do two things. They research and develop product, and then they operate and maintain equipment. That's it. The rest of you are not necessary.
Yeah.
Whether you're wearing a suit and tie or not.
Yeah. I'm telling you, man, you're preaching to the choir. I'm not going to say too much, right? But I am very aware of that. And I see it a lot. And unfortunately, businesses, we call it chiefs and Indians, right? I mean, they get heavy on the chiefs and people saying, this is what we should be doing. It's like, well, that's,
you know,
great.
Why it's okay to do that? So,
well, because it doesn't hit the P&L at the farm or at the facility.
So from a financial perspective,
sure.
Right,
it's not there.
It's part of contribution margin.
Sure.
It's not part of, you know, it's not in their cost of goods sold.
100%.
So when they go, we got to lower COGS.
Mm-hmm.
They're not talking about themselves.
No.
But nobody else in the plant realizes that.
That's right.
They think that's included.
That's right.
Unless they've gone to some finance classes.
Yep. It's like companies.
So they don't see it.
That's right. It's like some companies that I've spoken to about helping out with their financial alignment with maintenance. They're like, we spend so much on spare parts. And I go, how are you allocating those spare parts? Do you have a balance sheet? Do you have a threshold for what goes to the balance sheet and doesn't hit your P&L every month? What's that? It's like, well, not knowing that is going to put every single spare part on your P&L every single month.
Right.
Until you build a balance sheet. You understand what the needs of your balance sheet are, what the criteria is for the balance sheet, whether it's a dollar figure or a criticality figure or whatever it is.
Right. What is the cost to operate?
Sure.
That includes the parts necessary.
Correct.
That are wear components.
Correct.
On a regular basis.
Yep. And I hear that a lot too.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
People don't understand that the financial alignment and the financial, I could call it a kind of a game, right, is where are you putting your money that shows, like you could be, I could be the worst business ever and show profitability. Just on how I put, where I put my money.
Oh yeah.
So that's the thing. It's not different from manufacturing.
Right.
And you're right. If I hire five directors, they're not hitting the P&L at the facility, right? They're a corporate P&L. They're
right.
A regional P&L.
Right.
And then you go, you're
right.
We
gotta lower our costs. Fire.
Lower our costs. Get rid of all them, those people. Right.
Yeah.
I think also too, talking about like the role of an operator. And the pay structure and things, like it is very, the disparity is very real, right?
Yeah, it's huge.
In facilities that I've been a part of, you know, the operator's like, well, the mechanic makes $35 an hour. I make $15. And I'm like, wow, that is a disparity, right? of course, there's a lot that goes into that. But you would think that you have this super critical piece of equipment that you would want someone very, very competent, paid well, want to be involved in the operation of that machine to see through that that thing is doing what it's supposed to do and give them real ownership, right? And create the true value with them and that machine. I tell technicians all the time, it's like, you want to know what's going on with the machine, go talk to the operator. If they're worth their weight in anything, they're going to know more about it than you. Your job is to discern what about that lack of know is going to affect what you're doing.
Right. I've a real world example. I'm not going to mention company or anything. Yeah. Like that.
I'm trying to avoid that as well.
An organization that produces, we'll say, about 180 million units. We'll just say units annually.
That's a lot.
through multiple facilities. When you boil down the labor cost of operations, it's about 6 cents per unit.
Mm.
They've got all these projects to try to automate to reduce the operational staff. That accounts for 6 cents per unit. So even if you cut them in half, you're only getting 3 cents a unit back.
Right.
Of the 160 million units they make every year, in total profitability, the company has about $20 million. So they're not making much money per unit, right? They're only making 30 right. cents a unit.
What was the initial investment?
Right. Like there's lots of other sure. costs sitting there.
Sure.
6 cents is what you're going after.
Right.
But somehow there's a dollar on every product somewhere.
Right.
Like, why are you going after the 6 cents that you can't really get rid of entirely?
Yes.
And let's say the best thing you can do is cut it in half. Why are you going after the 94 cents that's sitting over here?
Right.
That you don't even know what's in it.
That's right. That's right.
But it happens all the time.
And some people I've talked to, some companies I've talked to, they don't even know that cost sometimes.
The worst is they have a financial strategy of, well, we sprinkle the cost across sure. everything.
Sure. So it kind of just goes away.
I'm lazy at my job, even though I've got five finance people in my department.
Right.
And we're only one plant.
Right, right.
But somehow we sprinkle cost, and I don't know the cost on an individual line.
Sure.
Well, what are you doing?
Right. I've asked, too, in the same line of thought there is, like, people always say, downtime's expensive. Downtime's expensive.
Okay, how expensive?
How much is it?
Right.
Tell me how much it is per hour.
Right.
What is it? Is
on
it
the every
amount,
line.
Is right. it the amount of units lost during a certain time period, or is it missed opportunity, meaning are you losing out on the market trend? Are you losing? What are all these things
right.
that attribute to downtime? What does it cost?
Right.
If you tell me what it costs, then I have something to go off of.
And it, look, because there's the other side of that coin too, right? Let's say they're operating at like 60% OEE.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I can get you to 80, what if you can't sell the units?
Yeah, exactly.
Then what the hell's the cost of your downtime?
That's right. That's right. And closer to your end of line of manufacturing, downtime is more expensive.
The cost of your downtime boils down at that point is the actual labor right. to produce it because right. you're just doing it over a longer period of time.
So I made a point to a customer one time where it was they're manufacturing something. I'm not going to say what it is because it would give it away. They're manufacturing something and then they stockpile it. Okay? They stockpile it. My argument was, what is the cost of downtime? Is it the cost of producing something, or does downtime matter when the reserve of product is gone? Because right now, if this machine's down for 10 hours, I'm just making stuff up, but that product doesn't leave until 20 hours, then downtime doesn't cost anything. Unless you talk about missed opportunity, right? Say you get an order,
right.
and now you need a surplus of stuff. But
how bad did they have to be that they decided, hey, let's build this warehouse to store stuff in because we're so bad at meeting delivery?
Sure.
We need the extra space.
Sure.
So they did that
sure.
to get rid of the cost of downtime, but then still say we have a downtime cost.
The better CapEx expenditure there would have been redundancy in your line or redundancy in a machine.
Yeah. Stop right. having the failure that's causing right. you to say, hey, we can't make our orders. Let's pile up our stuff.
Right.
Because there's a cost to it sitting
there's
there.
There's a cost to everything. Yeah. Right. You know, I try to get to the bottom of that, and no one really ever tells me what the cost of downtime is.
Yeah.
But it'd be very nice to know, you know, because then you can attribute so many things from it. You can literally go to the bank and say, I stopped this, or we stopped this.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
This is the dollar. And it's not my dollar. It's your dollar. You told me what it is. Here's what it is. So if you're saying it's wrong, then it's not my.
Right.
Internally, you need to figure out what downtime is. Right.
Yeah, no doubt. And like you said, lost opportunity cost.
Missed opportunity is huge.
Profitability cost, yes. The cost of rework, all yes. those things need to be known if you're in a maintenance department.
Yes.
Especially in a manufacturing facility, but you have to know those things or you can't make headway.
That's right. And talking about OEE too, OEE I think is also a very misunderstood thing.
No doubt.
You know it, dude. I've seen people just be like, oh, we're this effective. This is our OEE percent. I'm like, what's the availability? What's the performance? What's the quality? Well,
we plan to make X.
Yeah, yeah.
We made just under that, yeah, so we're at 90% OEE. No, that's not how that works.
What's the difference, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there are some pretty, I mean, switching gears here, there's some pretty cool solutions to that. Like there's some software companies out there and that offer really neat integrations, even with SCADA and like your BAS and like all these other systems.
We're big fans my mind just took a crap. the one that's open source. Really, you're just going to take a crap on
you? Got
to
tell
like
me,
that.
Man.
It'll pop in my head in a second. I can't believe it.
But they're really neat, right? You can really implementing them into the PLC into SCADA. You can get real time. It's not about tracking man hours on a work order and figuring out, okay, the machine went down at this time. Technician arrived. He was on the work order for 3 hours, so it's 3 hours of downtime, right?
Right.
Which is okay if it's just an identifier somewhere in space for you to realize where your time is going, right? But if you really want to understand manufacturing line downtime, you got to have OEE software, in my opinion.
And you have to be able to categorize all the downtime appropriately.
Correct.
Into the buckets associated
that's
with
right.
OEE.
That's right. And I think that problem types and failure codes on work orders will help you build that, right? So if you do your CMMS, if you have a strong work order system and you have failure codes and you have problem types, you can start to attribute those things when you start to build out your OEE software.
Right.
So if you say your problem type is electrical fault or no start or something like that, and you see that a bulk of their work orders are that, well, you want to have that button on the screen of that machine.
Right.
So when that thing stops, I hit no start or electrical problem, right? And that's an identifier in time for you to start building out something to address this
thing. Right. I've seen really bad systems where there's like all these barcode stickers everywhere. That's just
don't
bad.
Do that.
Yeah, yeah. You got to get it from the PLC. Whatever you can do to take the human out of collecting that data, take the human out of collecting that data.
At the very least, have an HMI.
Ignition.
Ignition's great.
Sorry.
Yeah. Ignition. Yeah, right. Works with SCADA really well.
Yeah.
And the program I'm talking about, too, is very interchangeable with them. But you, at least bare minimum, have an HMI that has 20 red blocks with what? Right. Line stopped, A, whatever A is.
But then you have to educate them, right?
Sure. And that's why an operator being paid is so...
No kidding.
Right?
Yes.
They need to have a vested interest in that.
Because there's a big difference. Because all they'll do is it's down. Maintenance issue. Maintenance issue.
100%.
Maintenance issue. Meanwhile, like, there's no incoming raw material inspection, so you're putting crap on the line that it can't run.
Right.
And because maintenance is going to come out and change the settings that they're not supposed to be changing.
Are you reading my mind?
Not supposed to be changing. They'll change the settings to accommodate that product because it's either that or we don't run. So doing it with the interest of running, and I get that.
Good intention.
But then the next lot comes in and it's in spec. What happens to the equipment?
100%.
Doesn't run worth a shit. Maintenance issue. And meanwhile, none of these are maintenance issues.
That's right.
That just burns my ass.
Yes, and it's nice when companies have a process improvement department or an operational excellence department.
Well, it's nice when they actually understand operational excellence.
True. True. I'll say that. When you have an operational excellence that understands operational excellence, right? And they'll come in and they put the brakes on a lot of that stuff, right? If you're gonna go through an engineering level access to a machine, you have to have a passcode, right?
Right.
The operator there that's doing widgets is not gonna know how to go into the engineering code and change the fill line speed to X. But it all goes back to, do you wanna have a competent, vested person addressing your $20 million machine? Or do you want a $15 an hour person who just wants to go home?
They want a $15 an hour person and three more finance people.
Right.
And that's, I mean, the proof is in the pudding.
The proof's in the pudding.
So that's what we get, right? And that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
And nowadays, they can't even find operators.
Right.
Because they do have to increase that pay because of the silver tsunami and all the other reasons why those folks are not taking those positions. And they don't really have much of a choice but to kind of raise their game a little.
Yeah.
And I think as the generation changes and you get the more high-tech folks that have been on their phone since 4 years old.
Hey, my new phone, right?
Becoming operators, they're going to be at a different education level and you're going to naturally kind of get some of that improvement.
That's right.
So I think some of it will happen naturally. But they're not going to get the understanding of OEE and product flow and business and understand what downtime costs or they're not, you know, you've got to educate these folks so you can get the most out of them.
That's right.
And it doesn't cost much to do that.
No, it doesn't. You have to have the initiative. Yeah. You have to want to do it. And you have to talk. You have to have a competent person to connect all those dots.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can get people in positions where they are trying to facilitate those things. They themselves don't know. I'm not faulting that person. I'm just saying that the success may be there, but the way it's being facilitated is stopping the success.
Yeah.
You know, and the value that is created by the people on the floor every day is what makes the manufacturing plant work.
Right? Yes.
If I'm not at work, the facility still runs, right?
Yeah. The operators aren't there. It's not running.
Exactly. Exactly.
And people need to recognize that.
Yes.
I think oftentimes there's, you know, I think part of the reason that people, maybe they look down on operator. I don't know what the issue is, but why they don't see them as a valuable input to process improvement, whether it's English isn't their first language, whether it, you know, for whatever reason, the hardest thing we do is get people to go out on the plant floor and say hello.
Right.
Like if I can convince people to do that, their plant will get better.
Right, yeah, because you're creating a relationship.
Just that.
Yeah, that's it.
Makes a huge difference.
Yes.
For two reasons. One, you build a relationship, people feel better, they do a better job at work. The second is you get to go walk by all the pain points. And then
you can't hide from
them. Why is that happening?
Mm-hmm.
And you go, well, that doesn't make any sense. And if you keep walking the floor, and every day you keep seeing it, eventually you're going to go, maybe we shouldn't do that no more. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Like getting people off their ass is the hardest thing to do.
Yes.
And the most valuable in the plant.
Yes. Sometimes too, like in my past lives when I'm sitting in my office and I'm reviewing some sort of business proposal or some sort of change or some project or something like that, I'm in there for hours and I literally get to the point where I'm like,
crap, I gotta go walk the floor.
like I gotta go walk around. I had a talk with Rob Kalborowski one time, and I was in my office in New Orleans, and I had like my high vis on. I'm all dirty, and he's like, what are you doing? I said, I was just out like running around. He's like, man, you're out there like getting. I said, I have to be. Yeah. How am I supposed to know what is going on? How am I supposed to know? I gotta know the people doing the work. I have to know that I have a relationship and trust with them. I have to know that they understand where they fit in the picture of what we're doing as a business, how it impacts them both professionally and personally, and how do I communicate all that, all while still trying to be the person who's like, oh, we're going to drive this change.
Right.
We're gonna expand over here.
All right, but that's the job, man. That's what you signed up for.
That's right.
And everybody that's listening, too bad. That's the job.
That's right.
That's the job. If you don't like it, don't improve.
Because
you're not going to get an improvement.
Yeah, you're not going to get it.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't have to tell you not to because it's not going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Keep trying by sitting on your butt.
That's right.
So previous to starting Reliability X, I was at a company and we were, Joe and I were actually working there and we were given line control of this particular line. And at that particular company, we had to wear a suit and tie. And every day when I went out to the floor to this particular line, really big line, about the size of a football field, I would shake everybody's hand. And if they were doing changeover, there would be product underneath of one of these particular conveyors because the pick and place robots weren't hitting their targets.
Right.
1,000 pieces under the conveyor. Mm. Every changeover. And if I was there, I was under the conveyor in my suit and tie helping the operators pull the product out from underneath the conveyor every time.
Right.
It didn't matter what was going on. If I happened to be there and changeover was happening, I left where I was at, went out, and pulled product out from underneath of that conveyor. And after some time, the line was given back to the site and their numbers started to decrease. I got a phone call from the person who was now responsible for that. What can I do different?
Go out there.
I said, be a better leader.
Like, go out there.
Be a better leader. I mean, we solved that issue, so it wasn't doing that anymore. Oddly enough, it was a really, really stupid issue, like just dirty air. Dirty, not cool, you know, wrong temperature, dirty, wet air.
Yep.
So they were changing whole banks of Festo valves weekly. Weekly.
That's a lot of money.
Oh, $250,000 a year in Festo valves.
Is that including labor?
No, just the cost of the valves.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding you. And that's, I went, wild. Why are you possibly doing that?
Wild.
Like, put in localized compressor, dryer, and get it properly. Make the issue go away. But, you know, other issues existed, right? And the numbers weren't going right. And the issue is leadership. I mean, it all boils down to leadership. Yes. All of it. Yes. All of it.
I like to think that, I told you, and people listening who know me will agree, I'm very aggressive when it comes to my pursuit of change, and to my, not aggressive in a mean way, but aggressive in, like, I'm not
going to... What was today's step?
Correct. I'm not going to sit idly by and let people try to bullshit me, right? And you just have to build the relationships, and I'm not perfect. So there's some people who I probably pushed away from me because of the way that I am, and created unfavorable relationships. And I admit that. But at the end of the day, I have to focus on what is going to drive the value for my department or my team, or if it, maybe I drove them away because I was protecting my team too much, or I was, the examples are endless, right? But when you say leadership is everything, I think it is. And I also think that competent leadership is so important.
Yes.
Right. Not just being a good, like, there's a lot of good leaders, right? Yeah. And they may not be competent in the thing that they're leading.
Right.
But they're still a good leader, and they know how to facilitate the open discourse.
But even they can be successful.
Sure, sure.
If they know how to surround themselves with the right experts, they can be successful, right?
100%. Yeah, yeah. They facilitate the discourse. Yeah. They get the right people where they need to be, and they don't placate. They don't play with politics. You know, they have a sound understanding of where people should be.
Right.
And then you have other leaders who are competent in the realm that they're leading. It just takes those people to learn the people side of it. Right, it's almost like we go back to the story. It's like the best mechanic is not always going to be the best leader.
That's correct.
Right, and the best leader isn't always going to be the best mechanic. He's not going to know everything.
Right.
So it's really finding that fine line and really understanding. And I'm speaking to senior people. Like, when you start promoting people and thinking about who you're going to promote, you should really, really do a 360 and talk to people they work with or people who work for them.
Yeah, hustle beats talent.
Every day. Every day.
Find a hustler.
Because in the realm of hustle, you're learning.
Yeah, you can teach a hustler.
That's right. Yeah. And I always say, and I'm a young guy, and I always say to people, it's not about the time, it's what you've done with the time.
Right.
Your point about a farmer, 50 years, 50 crops, or 50 years of one crop over and over again. What has changed in that 50 years? The technology, maybe. The crop's probably the same. But in 15 years of being a maintenance and reliability, I made as much impact for my professional growth and my facility's professional growth and my professional growth as much as I could. Like, I wanted to get out there. Right. I wanted to put myself out there. I wanted to fail. Failed a lot. a lot. And sometimes I'm aggressive with people who are following the same path that I made. And I'm like, don't do that. Like, bad. I made that mistake, and it's a world of problems. If we can avoid it even just a little bit, I want to avoid that.
Right.
So, yeah, leadership is a wild thing.
Awesome. How do folks find out more about yourself and Align Machine and all that stuff?
So I have AlignMachineCompany.com. You can Google that. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can email me. All that's on LinkedIn as well. And I'm always open to talking, to communicating about physical assets, problems, machines, and also holistic strategy, bigger business type thing. So I'm very open. I work a lot in the Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Delaware physical locations, but that hasn't stopped me from leaving those places to go talk to the right people. So
awesome. Well, Brian, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Good luck with the Align Machine. We you know, wish you the best.
Thank you.
I know that America kind of needs that. So I think it's a great service that you're providing. Yeah, no doubt. Did you go up to Canada and get in the convoy at all when that was going on?
No.
Could have got a lot of work there, you know what I mean? Yeah. But so thank you so much for being here. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Awesome. For Brian Bieschke, I'm George Williams. Go make tomorrow better than today.